Welcome to Everyday Miracles with Candace McClain, opening your mind to unlimited possibilities. Inspirational, compelling stories from leading transformers who motivate you to overcome the odds, break down barricades, and shift your beliefs, emerging stronger than ever. Share in the journey and find a new path full of miracles waiting to be discovered. Now, here's your host, Candace McClain.
Hello and welcome to Everyday Miracles. We're coming to you live on Transformation Talk Radio this fine Thursday. And to think the weekend's almost here, time for Halloween already. I am your host, Candace McClain, and thank you for tuning in. As always, we're going to open your mind to unlimited possibilities. And, you know, today we have just the person here to help us do that. Dr. Alan Hamilton, neurosurgeon and author, will be joining us shortly to discuss both his and his patients' many inexplicable experiences, which he chronicles in his book, The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope. If you haven't read it, it's a must read, and he's going to talk a lot about that today. But before I introduce Dr. Hamilton, we have a lot of new things coming up this November, and you can find out all about it by signing up for my newsletter. You'll find out about some new great books out there, some hypnosis CDs and MP3s. I'll be sharing some miracle stories in my newsletter as well. And, of course, there are always some new free downloads. So just go to www.CandaceMcClain.com. That's CandaceMcLean.com. And sign up today. And I also want to mention that if you're not a transformational member yet, you will want to be. Learn about the network's upcoming shows, our guests, and some really exciting contests that Dr. Pat's putting together. And just visit www.transformationtalkradio.com and enter your email address to sign up and be in the know. Some great things coming up this November. We're really excited, so don't miss out on that. But now, I've been looking forward to speaking with our guest today for some time. You know, believe it or not, Dr. Hamilton began his working life as a janitor and then went on to attend Harvard Medical School. I don't know how you do that, but we'll ask him today. We'll find out. And he became the chief of neurosurgery and the chairman of the Department of Surgery at the University of Arizona Health Sciences Center. He's the author, as I mentioned, of The Scalpel and the Soul, and he's also a script consultant in neurosurgery for the ever-popular TV drama Grey's Anatomy. Dr. Hamilton has been featured on National Public Radio, on CNN, Anderson Cooper's 360, and the Discovery Channel. He currently holds a main appointment as a professor in neurosurgery, as well as professorships in radiation oncology, psychology, and electrical and computer engineering. He's also the executive director of Arizona's Simulation Technology and Education Center at the University of Arizona School of Medicine. And this is where students, residents, physicians, and other health personnel are trained using simulation and virtual reality technology. But in addition to all of this, Dr. Hamilton is known as the doctor who whispers to horses. He runs a number of training programs where horses become the healers. At his ranch, the mission is to promote health, focusing on the important and integrated four directions of mind, body, spirit, and personal fulfillment. His facility offers programs in horsemanship, empowerment for cancer survivors, equine-assisted therapy, and inspirational leadership with a distinctly different approach. Through teaching an awareness of nonverbal communication and energy boundaries, the programs at the ranch foster lasting life-changing experiences. And Dr. Hamilton's second book about horses and healing will be released next year. Dr. Hamilton, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Candace.
It's really a pleasure to have you here. And like I said in your intro there, I'm really curious, how do you go from being a janitor to being chief of neurosurgery? How does that happen exactly?
I think there's a special track in medical school where they take you in. No, it actually was a fluke. I once got invited to career day at my daughter's high school, and I got up there and I said, I have no idea how to put a career together because it all happened by accident. I was a janitor, and I was trying to make ends meet, and I couldn't find work, so I took a job being what they call a kennel boy, which is cleaning up cages and dog poop and that kind of thing at a veterinary hospital. And they were during surgery, and I started getting really interested, and I guess I kept mopping the floor right opposite the operating room, and finally this veterinary surgeon took pity on me and said, look, if you can get your chores done early, why don't you come in here, and I'll see if you can't give me a hand. And one thing led to another. So it was the mop that got me to med school.
The mop got you there. But then you became addicted. It was the right career choice for you. You say many times in your book how the experiences you had in life seemed to choose you.
Well, you know, I think in a lot of ways we don't understand, or we take credit for things that we really have no business taking credit for. For example, it was not, you know, not my doing that I was lucky enough to be born in the United States, and where we can go to universities, and where a janitor can go on and become a brain surgeon if that's what they want to do. I could have been born in the third world and never survived the first year of life. You know, the odds of being me, when you think about it, of the odds of being the individual that we are genetically are, you know, one in a billion. And so you start to say, well, you know, how does that all fit together? And you say, I really can't grasp that. So everything that happens sort of looks like an accident, but on the other hand, you could turn around and say, well, maybe that was the way it was meant to happen. And, you know, maybe I was meant to start off as a janitor because that was all, you know, predetermined for me, that one thing would lead to another.
Right, yeah. One of the things you talked about in the book that I really enjoyed was the story about your experiences as a doctor in Africa and the impact of that whole experience, including a stranger's dream. Could you relate that story to our listeners today?
Sure. That was really, in a lot of ways to me, that was sort of the story I wanted to start the book off with, even though it's not the first one, because that was a watershed event for me. I had gone to Africa and as on a fellowship, and, you know, had come from Boston and was sort of all, you know, full of myself. And one of the things that we had to do was go out and vaccinate villages. And we would go out in these little kind of dugouts with a motor at the end of them. And we got our boat all ready, and we were all ready to go. And then during the night, it rained and the water rose and the boat was lost, and we had to repack everything, so we were delayed. And by that time, the river had risen so high, there were so many channels that we were lost trying to find the villages where we were supposed to go to vaccinate. And we get to this one fork where the guide that I'm with says, you know, look, we got to be careful. One side leads to the Atlantic Ocean, in which case we're going to be dead, and the other leads to the village. And I sort of said, well, which one is it? And he says, I can't tell with all the flooding. I have no idea which way to go. And I said, well, let's just crash in the fork before we get carried away. And we did, and we pulled ourselves up, and we were struggling to, you know, not get swept away. And, you know, I'm sitting there panting in the middle of the mud and everything, and I look and I see these feet in front of me, and I look up, and there's this beautiful gentleman with a mane of gray hair, just looking down at us like we're the two most pathetic things he's ever seen. And I look up at him, and I said, oh, thank God you're here, you know, we're lost. And he says, I know. And I sort of, you know, and I get all puffed up, and I go, oh, no, you don't understand. I'm a doctor here, and I'm supposed to go to this village and vaccinate children. And he says, I know. You know, he said, that's why I'm here. And I'm like really confused. And so, what do you mean? He says, well, I had this dream that you were going to come and you would be lost. And my dream told me that I was supposed to wait for somebody here at this fork in the river and take them to the village because they would be lost. And he says, the funny thing is, the dream told me to be here yesterday. And there was no way he could have known about the boat getting lost and us taking one extra day. There wasn't a cell phone. There's no smoke signals, no radio, nothing. So I'm just sitting there in the middle of the African jungle going, wait a minute. So my ability to fulfill my mission as a doctor is now dependent on the dream of a perfect stranger. And he has so much faith in that dream, he waits 24 hours. I mean, I just said, this is like just too much to figure out. So I like had one of those uh-oh experiences where I go, maybe, you know, everything doesn't work the way I think it does, where I learned back in Boston. You know, maybe it doesn't all answer to the rules of science that that we believe in so much.
And what was your upbringing in terms of spirituality?
You know, it was pretty routine. I was a Protestant. I was Lutheran. I was an altar boy. You know, I sort of, like most adolescents, I kind of drifted out of it. I've really never gotten back into, you know, organized religion. I've sort of always felt, you know, kind of spirituality is a matter of sort of personal consciousness more than anything. And, but, you know, it was like, I couldn't have been farther from my mind. I mean, this whole thing in Africa that then, you know, one thing led to another. And even to this day, I still get on the elevator with surgeons and they go, I can't believe with all the things you've done in surgery that you wrote a book about spirituality and medicine. And I go, I don't know. I sort of felt like we needed to be talking about it. But, you know, they're sort of taken aback. You know, they go, it's a really uncomfortable topic for a lot of doctors.
It is. And how did you find that the medical community, how did they embrace your book overall?
Well, it was weird. The younger doctors, and, you know, they were very, very receptive. They seem a lot more tuned into integrative medicine, holistic approaches to medicine. Interestingly enough, my mentors, whom I mentioned in the book, and whom I adored, I sent each one of them a copy, and not one of them even sent back an email saying thanks, because it was like, this is just dangerous territory for surgeons. Particularly surgeons were very conservative, and like
Absolutely.
The idea that things aren't the way we think or they aren't under our control really makes us nervous.
We're just going to move to a break right now. You're listening to Everyday Miracles. When we come back, we're going to hear more from Dr. Hamilton and some more of his supernatural experiences out there, one that will completely blow you away. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Reservage Organics offers you the most advanced anti-aging product available. Our organic-based resveratrol formula, brought to you from the heart of our exclusive vineyards in southern France, has been clinically proven to reactivate your longevity gene and help preserve your youth. By including Reservage resveratrol in your daily regimen, you can enhance cardiovascular function, metabolism, mental acuity, and collagen production. If you want to regain your youthful radiance and enhance your longevity, do so with the world's finest resveratrol from Reservage Organics. Why wait? Visit your local retailer and start the anti-aging process today. Reservage Organics, committed to the extension of youth naturally. Available online at reservage.com and at the Vitamin Shop, Vitamin World, and Whole Foods Market. Visit reservage.com and feel vitality today.
TransformationTalkRadio.com. TransformationTalkRadio.com, transforming the world one listener at a time.
Ladies, are you living an inspired life? Do you yearn for a more passionate, dream-filled life? Here's Linda Joy, founder of Aspire Magazine, and she has a gift for you.
Aspire has launched its Mission to Inspire initiative with a commitment to give away 100,000 one-year digital subscriptions to women around the globe. Every subscription comes with a multitude of free gifts from our team inspiration partners.
To claim it all, go to AspireMag.net today. No purchase necessary. And live an inspired life.
12:30.
And welcome back to the show. I'm your host, Candace McLean. My guest today is Dr. Alan Hamilton, the author of The Scalpel and the Soul. And Dr. Hamilton, if people want to find out more about you or your book or your work, how can they best get in touch with you to learn more?
Well, the easiest thing is just go to Scapel and Soul, and that'll get you there. Or you can look up allanhamilton.com, which is spelled A-L-L-A-N, Hamilton, all one word, .com, and that'll get you there, too.
Perfect. Thanks so much. So the Scalp on the Soul, it really did cover a lot of ground, I think, in terms of spirituality, in terms of rules for life, working with the medical community. But in particular, though, you discussed the supernatural and the many experiences that you had along with your patients.
Mm-hmm.
Would you say that your belief in the supernatural was really solidified during a certain experience? Was there one story or one experience that really initially struck you?
Well, you know, I mentioned the experience in Africa, and then I think, you know, I really approach this very much like a scientist. I kept trying to say, you know, you're having these experiences and they're kind of shaking you up, and then you sort of sweep them under the rug. And then you sort of say after a while, well, how many times are you going to bump into this and sort of ignore it? From a scientific point of view, it's like having some data that doesn't quite match. And then you start to say, you know, this is just not, I'm just not able to. And I'll give you a perfect little example when I talk to doctors that everybody agrees on. Every doctor has had the experience of a patient. When they looked at the patient, they absolutely were convinced there was no way they were going to survive past a certain time. And then that patient will say something like, you know, you look at them and you go, they're not going to make it for another 6 weeks. Their cancer's so out of control. And then they say, you know, I've got to make it another 6 months to my granddaughter's marriage. Or I got to make it another 9 months till my son comes back from Iraq so I can say goodbye. And every single time, practically, you will see that they make it. And you say, how does that happen? If this is just a biologic machine, how is it that the state, their emotional needs, their desire to reach closure, their desire to be there for their family for an event, how is it that they're able to put off this biologic process? And the answer is because we are able to summon a lot more emotional and spiritual and energetic resources than we really understand. And they do, under those circumstances, with those objectives in mind, they are able to do that. And so when you say it in those terms to doctors, they all shake their heads, yes. And then I say, and how many of you had an experience, you know, like in the middle of the night in an ICU, somebody, some incredible miracle happens in front, you turn to the nurse that you've known for years and you go, did you see that? And they go, yeah. And they go, that was a miracle, wasn't it? And they go, yeah. And then you turn and say, well, how come we don't talk about it? And they go, well, they'll think we're crazy if we do. And so that's sort of the underlying idea that that we do see miracles, and they happen every single day in every single hospital. And somehow, you know, there's so many issues about spirituality and about the patient's emotions and about their family resources and, you know, even things like negative energy and positive energy. And then you somehow we sort of sweep that all on the rug and say, no, let's talk about antibiotics because I feel really comfortable talking about, or, you know, surgical technique. Mm-hmm. And you sort of blow off the rest of it. But we all know that it makes a huge difference in patients' recoveries and their will to live. We've seen it a million times.
So I would imagine that this must be coming up more in teaching hospitals. New physicians coming on board, new residents. Isn't there a component of spirituality being covered these days?
More and more. And I think part of it is not just within the profession. I think as patients, as consumers, we're a lot more insistent that you have to deal with me with all of my issues and all of my strengths, and I'm not just a disease. I'm a full-fledged human being with a heart and a soul and a mind, not just a body. I'm not just an appendix in room 643. Right. And I think there's more and more of that, and I always remind people that you know, when my mom had me as a baby, my father was in the waiting room with cigars in his pocket and waiting for the doctor to come out, and all the women were sequestered in the labor and delivery area. And now, you know, what happens is the mother and the spouse or significant other, they're in the delivery room and they're participating and they're cutting the umbilical cord as a symbolic act of this transition from one stage of life to another. And I go, who'd you think thought that up? Do you think a bunch of obstetricians got around a table and said, well, we think this will be a meaningful experience? That it wasn't. It was basically women saying, I'm not going to live my life like this. I'm not going to give birth to my child without my spouse or my significant other participating in this incredible experience with me. And they changed the whole face of obstetrics. So I think the same thing's happening now, particularly with the baby boomers coming through and them being such a powerful force in medicine, and they're going, I'm not willing to be passive about this. I am not going to allow you to make me into an object.
Yeah, and you talk about that in the book. Don't be just another patient. Make sure your concerns are heard. You even talk about having, what did you call it, a guardian angel.
Guardian angel. I mean, first off, I don't think people are aware. There are so many mistakes within the medical system. It's just rampant. In fact, what we call medical adverse events, which is sort of our nice term for a mistake, is the fourth leading cause of death now in the United States. We're going to kill 5 times more people from medical adverse events that are going to die on the highways of America. So what I say is, look, the patient can't do this, but you have to assign somebody you love and trust to sort of take down every detail, every appointment, every test that should be run, everything that runs in your body, every pill they give you, every doctor who says, I'm going to come back and see you at 4:30, just write it all down and let them sort of be, for lack of a better word, the son of a bitch who sort of says, no, I'm not happy that the IV ran out. I want you to replace that bag.
Yeah. Double-checking the pills, double-checking what time they're supposed to come in. Yeah. You really have to manage your own health care. And it's okay. And the thing is, I can see a lot of people in the medical industry being upset about that, being asked, nurses being asked, okay, can we make sure? Can I check that dosage? But this is something we have to do now just because of all the errors that exist.
Well, you know, I always say, how many people keep speeding down the highway when they see the patrol car in the underpass? We all slow down. And I said, it's the same thing in medicine. If we know people are interested, they have questions, they're going to have expectations, we're going to try and meet them.
Yeah, yeah. Now, in one of the last chapters of your book, you talked about a very interesting surgery, and it wasn't one that you were actually involved in at the time, but it's something you researched after. And this was the one where the patient's heart and brain activity were stopped in order to operate. I think it was on an aneurysm.
Yep, it was on a basilar aneurysm, right.
Right.
It was a very dangerous blood vessel, and the only way to really get to it was to stop all the blood flow. And the way they did this was with a heart-lung bypass pump. And they cooled the patient down, and they stopped her heart, and they stopped the blood flow. And you really had about, 15, 17 minutes in which you could operate. And during that time, you have electrodes on the brain. There's absolutely no oxygen, no blood flow, and no electrical activity. While this operation was going on, there's a lot of tension, as you can imagine, at first. But then the blood vessel was repaired relatively quickly, and everybody breathed a sigh of relief. And they start chit-chatting like we all do. And one of the nurses was talking about over the weekend she'd gotten engaged, and she'd been at this restaurant, and she'd gotten her engagement ring at this place and that. And everybody's just chatting it up. And eventually they start the pump back up, and everything goes very smoothly. And, after the case, they go and they're talking to a woman, checking up on her in the ICU, and she's doing fine. And, she says, look, I have this funny thing. I overheard a conversation, and, and she starts telling the conversation word for word. The name of the restaurant, the jewelry store, everything that had happened.
And even though she was technically dead.
Her brain wasn't working. I mean, they had the electrical evidence in front of them. Now, everything that we know in neuroscience says, if your brain is not working electrically, if your brain is dead, that's how we determine people are brain dead. There's no electrical activity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if your brain is dead, you cannot make a memory. If you do not have electrical activity, you can't make a memory. And yet, we know that somehow these memories were made when her brain wasn't able to make them, and then she was able to access them later. And so you sort of say, well, how does that happen? You mean there's an existence, there's a consciousness that's separate from the electrical activity of the brain? And, you know, I don't know if this is as close as I'll get to the Holy Grail of finding the soul, but it certainly made me jump as a neuroscientist going, I see the evidence in front of me. She shouldn't have been able to remember that conversation. And, you know, this has happened multiple times, and it certainly makes you wonder, well, is this giving us a different paradigm to think about that there's someplace else that we can be than besides our own brain? So it was just very intriguing, and it was really, to me, it was sort of a little bit, I have to say, I was sort of wanted to get more from the patient in some ways, because I felt like these were things I needed to know. They needed to help me believe in things, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. And what was the reaction of other researchers into this, or other people in the medical community who looked into that case?
Oh, everybody was sort of trying to tear it apart. You know, we were all trying to find what was wrong, and people were looking at the EEGs, and people were looking at, you know, could this have been wrong, could that have been wrong? And in point of fact, people showed the EEGs to a group of people who had never seen the patient or knew anything about them, and they all said, this patient's brain dead. And, you know, so there was no doubt in the electrical records and that sort of thing. And, you know, it's actually happened multiple times, and it sort of freaks you out a little bit.
Absolutely. You know what, Alan? I'm just going to let you hold that thought for a moment.
Okay.
And we'll come right back. I'm Candace McClain. You're listening to Everyday Miracles on the Transformation Network. When we come back, Dr. Hamilton's going to finish what he was saying, and he's going to talk to us about prayer and the power of hope. Can it really affect your recovery? We'll be right back.
Remember, for our dogs and cats to live long and happy lives, just like people, they are what they eat. Wellness Carefully selects wholesome ingredients to create food you can trust to provide the foundation of your pet's well-being. True wellness means every ingredient has a purpose in every recipe they make. You can trust the quality of all ingredients in wellness from their source to your pet's bowl. Visit wellnesspetfood.com to find a pet specialty retailer near you. Wellness Natural Food for Pets. This is where true wellness begins.
Are you feeling stuck? Do you want to be free from fears and doubts and finally feel good about yourself, but you just don't know how to get there? Dr. Schaub's Accelerated Breakthrough Program provides you with the tools and solutions to go beyond your limitations and achieve self-empowered confidence. Call for your free phone consultation at 866-903-MIND. Visit CellularWisdom.com. That's CellularWisdom.com.
We are living in a time of great challenges and greater opportunity for transformation. The good news is that public awareness of the need for change is also growing exponentially. More than ever, your transformative message is needed to empower millions across the globe.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pat, host of the Dr. Pat Show, and I'm excited about announcing an unprecedented opportunity for growth as we expand our broadcast by launching Transformation Talk Radio and the Transformation Network. Join me and a team of amazing people and host your own show on Transformation Talk Radio. Get ready to expand your horizons, tap into the best listeners anywhere, and join one of the most positive and expansive networks today.
Historically, there came a time when the boundary of water was transcended as man developed the boat, and the barriers of water became freeways. Join Dr. Pat as she launches this exciting venture. To host a show, call 1-800-930-2819 or email host at transformationtalkradio.com.
Are you taking too many oral pain pills and concerned about side effects? Are you having trouble getting to sleep because of the pain? Well, I'm Lou Paradise. I had the same problems you have. Cured my pain, eliminated pain pills and their side effects by developing Toprasin, pain relief and healing cream. Toprasin relieves pain without side effects. It doesn't burn, it doesn't smell, and it doesn't stain. But don't just take my word for it. Doctors, pharmacists, and pain specialists are using and recommending Toprasin and ending the suffering for thousands of people just like you. We know you're hurt. We want to help. We're so sure Topperson will work for you, we offer a money-back guarantee. So if you want pain relief with no side effects, ask for Topperson. Topperson is available at Bi-Mart, New Seasons, and other fine health food stores and co-ops. Ask for Topperson or call 1-800-959-1007 for a store nearest you. That's 1-800-959-1007. Topperson, the last pain medicine you'll ever need, and you can sleep on that.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Everyday Miracles. I'm Candace McLean, and I have Dr. Alan Hamilton here with me today. And Alan, you were just talking about that wonderful story from your book about the woman who was clinically dead but had an accurate memory of the conversation that took place between the medical staff while she was clinically dead. And you know, it's interesting when we look at that and how different people respond to it. Was there ever a final report on that? What was the final say-so on that?
No, I mean, everybody sort of just put up their hands and, as I said, you know, just threw up their hands and said, we can't explain it. And we, you know, we're taught all the time that you can't make memory without electrical activity in the brain cells themselves. You know, and here the electrodes are right on the brain, so you can't get a more accurate recording. And yet, you know, here we're faced with this paradox. It doesn't make any sense. It defies everything we understand. Memories got to be made somewhere, but they're not being made in the brain. Yet, at later date, she has a memory. So, you know, I think we always catch glimpses of kind of the unknown or the inexplicable. And I always say, well, you know, if you went back 2,000 years to the Greeks and they saw what we were doing and what we were thinking now, they'd think we were gods who'd come down from Olympus. It would all be supernatural to them. And I think we are constantly pushing back the frontiers of what we understand about how our brains work, how the cosmos works. You know, I think the brain has so much more capability than we really gave it credit for, and we're just beginning to discover, you know, what some of its powers now. And we keep rewriting the chapters.
Absolutely. And so much of it happens at that subconscious level. You know, when we walk into a room or even our closet in our house, at a level that we're not aware of, we can go through every item in that closet and remember where we got it from, where we wore it. You know, this bad thing happened when I was wearing that. And we're not even aware that that's going on. But we take in so much and our mind takes in so much. So really, who knows what are we capable of? And I know with hypnosis, I've worked with a lot of people who, you know, we've gone in and we've gone back to memories of things that they didn't know they had a recollection of. I actually worked with one woman who went back to before she was adopted as a baby, and she had memories of her biological parents and what their situation was. Now, she's trying to prove it, but what all can we access? It's really amazing when we start looking into that.
There was a set of experiments years and years ago by a neurosurgeon, a brain surgeon named Wilder Penfield, and it was one of the reasons I got so interested in neurosurgery. And he used to do studies of seizure patients, and the brain has no pain receptors. So actually, if you can anesthetize the skull and the scalp, you can actually operate on the brain with the patient wide awake, which sounds kind of weird, but it's true because it has no sense of pain. So he would actually stimulate these patients intraoperatively to find out where the seizures were. And he actually could touch certain areas which would trigger memories. And there's a whole bunch of very famous cases, but I'll just tell you about one that he had. And the patient was a bricklayer. And what he found is when he touched a certain part of the brain and asked the patient what he was experiencing, this mason said, oh, I'm working on a building, and they were in Montreal General Hospital. He says, I'm working on a building that we're putting up in downtown Montreal, and I'm putting bricks in. And then he'd lift his electrode off the brain, and the memory would stop. And then he put it back on, and the guy said, well, now I'm two rows higher, and we're still putting bricks on, and then he'd lift it off. And so then they said, they put the electrode back on. He says, tell me what you're doing. He says, well, I'm on the 17th row of bricks. I'm two rows from the end. I'm putting a brick in that has a chip in it, and they took the electrode off. And they went back and actually counted the bricks. And it was exactly that brick 20 years earlier that he put in, but he had remembered right it down to the very chip in it. And this led Wilder Penfield to hypothesize that we remember everything in our lives. We suppress those memories because there's so many billions and trillions of them that we can't be flooded with all of them. But they're really, every one of them is there down to the smallest detail.
Yeah.
So it kind of ties back to this whole thing of hypnosis being able to take you to memories that you can't access in a conscious way. And this guy couldn't have remembered the exact brick and the row and where it was with a chip, but it was all there.
Well, you know, and here's the other thing. I've regressed people back to actually being in the womb. And they knew on the day that they were being born what the conversation was that was happening in the room between, you know, their mother and the medical staff, or the feelings, the emotions that the mother had at the time. I mean, it sounds out there, but, you know, it's true. People go back and they check with their mothers, and yes, this is the case, and this is what the room looked like.
Well, you know, there's another thing about being in the womb that really I'm always a little focused on. Let me tell you why. People always say to me, what about near-death experiences? And I talk a little bit about it in the book about them. And I was struck by near-death experiences. First, I've never met a patient who had a near-death experience that didn't think it was one of the most beautiful experiences of their lives. Mm-hmm. And it's the same across cultures. It's been reported hundreds of years ago. So you sort of say, well, you know, is this showing us like maybe the first half little inch of the journey on the other side? And you know, then people say, well, you know, you can't really know. You don't know what's on the other side. And I always point out, if, you know, you've been in utero, you've been in the womb, and if I was trying to talk to you and tell you what life was like as a person living outside the womb, and I said, you know, you have parents and there's trees and you're going to see beautiful mountains and grow up and have children of your own and fall in love, and you'd go, I have no idea what you're talking about. I have no knowledge of anybody else. I'm here in the womb. It's just me. Everything I want is met. I have no idea what you're talking about. And I said, we've already been through one transition in our life, where we went from one set of life to a completely inexplicable new stage of life that we couldn't understand in the first stage. And I said, who's to say that the next stage of life, the one that's after this, if it exists, isn't so totally inexplicable that it's just as strange as the first transition that we all know we went through?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think this thing about in utero is a fascinating transition point for all of us.
So I'd imagine that your beliefs about death have changed because of the experiences of your patients.
Yeah, what I always say is, look, I don't know, and you know, nobody knows. But I said, you got two choices. You only have two choices. You can bet that when you die, it's all over, and you just come to a complete and total end. And I said, if that's the case, so does the whole universe, because it's completely dependent upon your perception, and now you're gone. So it's all over. I said, or the other alternative is that there's something else beyond it. And I said, when you look at the logic, if you look at the experience, if you look at near-death, and if you look at the complexity of life, and you look at the things that we feel, if you go to the full extreme and you say to yourself, which one of these two options would you want to bet is most likely? I would say it's far more likely that there is a life after this one than that there isn't, that this is just a mortal experience and it means absolutely nothing. You know, I mean, you can turn around and say, look, I'm just one little speck of humanity on one little planet around one sun that's one of 100 billion stars that's in 100 billion galaxies, and I mean absolutely nothing. And then you go back but you know that you mean a great deal. You know that you are very meaningful, so then in the full cosmic spectrum there, you have incredible meaning. You know, I go back to this line that you in the Bible, which is, you know, God notices if a single sparrow falls out of the sky. And that strikes me, if there is a God, that's exactly how it would be. That every little life and every facet and every beautiful little thing would matter.
Yeah. You talk quite a bit about hope. And the power of having hope. How much do you feel hope helps us in recovery or to survive?
I think it's vital. Look, I learned about hope, as I wrote in that book, I learned about it the absolute hard way. I had a patient and with a brain tumor. He was doing great. He was young. We had thrown every kind of therapy that we could get to get his tumor under control. And, you know, he's doing great. And one day he was a very avid fly fisherman. And one day he took me aside and he says, "Doc, you know I'm going to beat this thing, but if ever you have to, you know, I want you to be able to tell me when it's time to go fishing." And he was very pointed about it. He says, "You know what I mean?" And I go, "Yeah." And he said, "Promise me." And I said, I promise." And he did very, very well for many years. And then, unfortunately, the tumor recurred, and we operated on it, and he needed multiple therapies again. And it was just spreading. It was growing to both sides of the brain and around the spinal cord. And I'd operated on it for the fifth time. And we just had this moment where we were alone in the room. And I said, "You remember years ago when we said, you know, we talked and you asked me if it was ever time to go fishing?" And he looked at me, he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, it's time." And he looked like I had stuck a pin in him and deflated him. And the next morning, his family called me and told me he had died during the night. And that wasn't because I was a great, you know, diagnostician or, you know, knew right. The prognosis. It was because he saw me lose hope in him, and then he lost hope in himself. And you know, I took away his hope, and that's what he died from. And then I realized, you have no right to take away anybody else's hope. That is a human right, a human need. And hope is the desire to prevail against overwhelming odds. There is no such thing as false hope. And when you see it over and over and over again, the patients who hope with the greatest ardor are often the ones who have the best survival and even cures. And you just go that this hope is an incredibly powerful thing. And I want my patients to harness their hope. I made a terrible mistake. And, you know, people say, "Well, what would you do now? You promised him." And I said, "What I would promise him is if he came to me and said it's time to go fishing, that I would support him whenever he made that decision."
Yeah.
I'd have a different attitude about it.
He wanted that honesty, too. We're just going to move into another break right now. You're listening to Everyday Miracles. When we come back, we're going to learn more about Dr. Alan Hamilton and some of the other things that he's involved in, such as horses. We'll be right back.
Let's be honest. Weight loss boils down to choices. The Take Shape for Life program features clinically tested products from Medifast that have been recommended by over 20,000 doctors in the last 30 years. There's free support from certified health coaches who've experienced personal success with the Take Shape for Life program. Talk to a health coach. Listen to the passion in their voice and their story that started with a choice. Call 1-877-520-SIMPLE. That's 877-520-SIMPLE. Results will vary. Talk to your doctor before starting program. Call for details.
Remember, for our dogs and cats to live long and happy lives, just like people, they are what they eat. Wellness carefully selects wholesome ingredients to create food you can trust to provide the foundation of your pet's well-being. True wellness means every ingredient has a purpose in every recipe they make. You can trust the quality of all ingredients in wellness from their source to your pet's bowl. Visit wellnesspetfood.com to find a pet specialty retailer near you. Wellness natural food for pets. This is where true wellness begins.
The 19th Annual Women of Wisdom Conference is February 17th through the 21st. Our theme is Women Arise, Unveil the Power of the Divine Feminine. Special guests are Susan Weed, Carolyn Sutherland, and many others, sharing their gifts through experiential events all weekend long. Join our email list at womenofwisdom.org and watch for announcements about the conference. That's womenofwisdom.org.
After a 15-year search for a truly delicious, healthy, easy-to-prepare organic meal, Savitri and Adil Pakivala founded Eastern Essence. They set out to do what their friends and business acquaintances thought impossible, to produce delicious, healthy, vital food grown in harmony with nature and to promote organic farming in India. Happy food, happy people, happy planet. For more information, go to EasternEssence.com. That's EasternEssence.com.
I'm your host, Candace McLean, and I'm joined here by Dr. Alan Hamilton, author of The Scalpel and the Soul. Alan, one of the things I do want to cover quickly for our listeners today is some of the things that they should keep in mind when, you know, they're in the hospital or working with a doctor. What's some of the advice that you have for them?
Well, you know, we talked about this whole thing about don't let yourself become a patient. I mean, hospitals say, you know, they sort of take off your clothes, leave your wedding ring at home. You know, they give you these crazy hospital gowns that are slit open in the back. And I always say to my patients, look, bring your favorite T-shirt, bring your sweatpants, wear your fluffy bunny slippers. Bring things from home that remind you of your life. Bring, you know, we all have these little talismans, and they remind us of, you know, why we're alive. And I always, whenever I walk in a patient's room and I see all the crayon drawings from their grandkids and a photograph of the family, and there's lots of people around the bed and their favorite quilt and their favorite pillow, I go, great, this is a person who's really assembling a lot of personal energy. You know, if I go in the room and they're just this one person all alone, swallowed up in a hospital bed, and they've got no questions, and they go, doctor, it's whatever you think best, I go, uh-oh, we're going to have a lot of complications here. So the first thing is that, you know, bring all your power to bear on it. The second thing is avoid negative energy. You know, I walk in sometimes in a hospital room after surgery, and they're watching the news, and I go, do you really want to watch this? I mean, you know, you want to hear about all the terrible things that are happening in the world? Or, you know, maybe you should put on a sitcom or watch your favorite funny movie. You know, Norman Cousins wrote a whole book about this. It's really important to realize these things impact us. And, you know, we need all the positive energy we can while we're recovering. You know, last but not least, use music, use prayer if that's what moves you. You know, avoid people who are going to get you upset. And, you know, last but not least, it sounds like a silly thing, but if you don't connect with your doctor, don't use him or her. You know, people spend more on average 45 minutes shopping in a car lot for a car. 7.5 minutes from the time a surgeon walks in to the time the surgeon walks out with a consent that you put your life in his or her hands. And I go, you know, there's something wrong with that. I go, if you're not connecting emotionally with that doctor, find somebody else.
You need to feel that you can speak with them openly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So those are just a couple of the very simple rules. Don't let doctors rain on your parade. A good doctor should be like a coach who's sort of saying, come on, we're going to get the best possible recovery and, you know, performance. You're going to win the gold medal. Let's go. And, I say that's what you got to have. And there are a lot of doctors who just, you know, overwhelm you with statistics. And everybody needs to know the truth. But they also need to understand for every statistic, there's an exception.
Okay, yeah, because you talked a lot about that in the book as well. You caution a lot of patients about, you know, things like cure rates and prognosis. But at the same time, people want this information. They want to know, you know, where they're at on that scale.
Absolutely. And, you know, we all go through that. And, you know, you got to remind yourself, I can predict what's going to happen to 10,000 patients, but I can't predict what's going to happen to one. And, you know, you got to say to yourself, okay, though, you know, if I'm cured, that's 100% for me. And, you know, I think, you know, people have to realize those statistics guide therapy, but they don't tell us what's going to happen to you. And you have to remember your singularity, your individuality is also your salvation.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah. I wanted to move into talking about the equine-assisted therapy that you do. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, my grandfather was a cavalry officer in the Austrian cavalry and rode horses in the Spanish riding school, and so I sort of got a genetic bug for horses. And we began realizing, you know, like many people did, that horses offer kind of a unique way of contacting us. They're prey animals, we're predator animals, and they don't care what you say. They really only care what you feel. They read our body language very, very accurately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I began to realize this is a very potent tool because, you know, you get to look at the horse and say, am I connecting to that horse or am I not? And the horse says, when you connect, here's the reaction you get. When you don't connect, here's what you get. And they sort of force us into a kind of an emotional integrity, if you will, and they put us in touch with our own emotions. You know, if I go into the round pen with a horse and I'm thinking about, oh, I got to go to work and I got to make sure the car gets dropped off and, you know, I'm a little worried about what my boss is going to say this afternoon, and then the horse says, whoa, you are not focused on me at all, are you? And you go, yeah, you're right. I'm completely and totally distracted. I don't belong in here. I got to step out of the round pen and get clear, and then I'll come back. So I think horses offer a great way to, we do courses now with medical students on nonverbal communication and bedside manner, because for so often what happens to patients is their doctors say one thing, but their bodies are saying a completely different thing. You know, they're looking through the chart or they're looking through the x-rays and they're asking you to pretend that they're interested in you. And you go, that's a lack of integrity. When your mouth says something that your body doesn't say, that's a lack of integrity. And we pick it up right away. We pick it up in interviews. In fact, most job interviews, the decision to give the person or deny the person the job is made within the first 30 seconds of the interview. Because we react at a gut level much, much faster than we do at a cognitive level. And so horses are saying, look, guess what? I connect to your gut. So for cancer patients are great, because cancer patients are often saying, look, think about the metaphor. Here's something large, powerful, possibly out of control, and I somehow have to make a relationship with that that's a partnership where I can get along with this. And so you say, well, horse is large, powerful, potentially out of control. What a great thing to have to try and negotiate and figure out, well, how do I do it with this horse, and then how do I apply that, you know, to my cancer and my cancer survival? You know, we do it with a business school for negotiating skills. You can do it for psychotherapy. And so often for kids, they'll react at an emotional level, at a body level, with that horse long before they'll do verbal therapy with the therapist. So you can get some real breakthroughs that way. So it's a very useful technique, and I hate to say it, I've learned an awful lot about how to be a better human being from horses.
Yeah, and you've traveled around the world, I believe, with this program as well, haven't you?
Oh yeah, and we're involved in, we've been in Europe, all over the United States. We're involved in a lot of efforts here to save horses. In Ireland, we were there. They have a big national thoroughbred racing industry, and a lot of these horses never, you know, go on and race. They need a new life. So since it was a national industry in Ireland, we were able to talk to the Irish government with the help of a group there called HEALS, run by a wonderful guy named Kevin Smith, and literally talk to the legislature about, can we give these horses a second life as therapeutic partners for kids and school systems and so on. And so, you know, it's just a wonderful thing. It feels great to be able to participate with these people in fostering it.
Yeah, what a beautiful concept, and to work with animals is just something so special about them. And so this is also the topic of your new book that I believe is coming out next year.
Right. Tentatively, we're calling it Zen Minds and Horse, Spiritual Principles that Life, that Horses Bring to Life. And one of the purposes of this book is to say, look, when you work with a horse, you're seeing spiritual principles. You're applying them. Just like I said, getting clear. You know, I've got a clear sept. But with a horse, it's a very real concept. If I'm not clear with my horse, if my thinking isn't completely clear, if I don't know the goal that I want for my horse can't accomplish it. When my thinking is clear, my intent is focused, that horse, it'll suddenly be effortless for that horse. And I go, here's a way that you can have spiritual principles. You can try, anybody can try them out. A novice, a person who's never seen a horse in their life, you can put them to work and say, I'll show you this principle. I'll show you how it works. Now go use it in your life because you've seen it work with a horse.
And you're doing this in Arizona.
In Arizona,
right?
Yes.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where our ranch
okay.
is.
And,
yeah.
And you have a ranch there. Okay. Well, this hour has gone by so quickly. And I
For
have
me
all
too.
These
For
things
me
I'd
too.
Love to talk to you about. But I'd like to thank you so much for joining us today and sharing your experiences and your wisdom. And, you know, I would love if you would come back and talk to us when your new book comes out.
Oh, it'd be my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Candace. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
And for those listeners who are interested in reading the book, The Scalpel and the Soul, Encounters with Surgery, the Supernatural, and the Healing Power of Hope, they can just go to your website, right, Alan?
Absolutely.
www.alanhamilton.com, and that's Alan with two L's. Again, thank you so much for speaking with us. I can't wait for your new book. And thank you to all of you for tuning in to Everyday Miracles. Please join me every Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific Time. Have a phenomenal Halloween. We'll see you back here next week for another Everyday Miracles. Take care.
You've been listening to Everyday Miracles with Candace McClain, opening your mind to unlimited possibilities. Tune in Thursdays at 2 p.m. Pacific and 5 p.m. Eastern on TransformationTalkRadio.com for Everyday Miracles, where a new path full of miracles is just waiting to be discovered.